My next guest will be familiar to regular listeners of this program, for it is Evan White, the producer of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Evan has been largely responsible for the website poetrytechnology.com, which has provided, for months now, audio representations of the actual interviews recorded on this radio show. Visit poetrytechnology.com to find out more about that and to find out more about Evan. Evan, are you represented on the website? Is there a bio or something for you?
There is.
Excellent. Well, we'll refer people to that. They can also listen to this bio that I'm about to read, largely edited on the spot. Evan White is the co-founder of Absurd Publications and one of the editors of the anthology All the Vegetarians in Texas Have Been Shot, to which he was also a contributor. Evan White graduated with a degree in English from the University of California, Davis, and has appeared regularly on KDBS, his favorite radio station, for the past year. First on the Llama Radio Show, that's L-L-A-M-A, and then more recently, in fact, presently, currently, on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Evan White wrote for the California Aggie for a time, and now he serves as the editor of The Oddity, Absurd Publications' monthly creative journal. His work is not widely read, he says, nor is it yet published broadly. And his peers have described his poetry as, quote, stories with line breaks. Evan, he was a featured performer earlier this year at Absurd Publications' Word of Mouth Reading Series. In 2013, he will begin work at the Mandavi Center for Wine, Food, Brewing, and Culture. I don't think the word culture is in the title, but I'm just adding things as I go.
If there's wine, there's culture.
Absolutely. Liquid culture is wine. I should add that Evan's going to read a story to us, a nonfiction narrative. The names of some of the players have been changed. He says listener discretion is advised. The story contains adult material. If you're a parent or a person with very sensitive ears, you should know that I will be standing over the 4-second dump button so that I can dump 4 seconds of our conversation. You'll be interested to know that this conversation is actually taking place 8 seconds before you hear it. While you wrap your brain around that, I will say this. Evan White, welcome back to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you very much.
Well, I took up pretty much most of your reading time with that introduction.
That's just fine.
Why don't we dive right into the story so that we have time for a PSA at the end? I'll let you finish your coughing, but meanwhile, tell us, what is the title of this essay?
This is a story called The Plumber's Wife.
The Plumber's Wife. And this is what we would call creative nonfiction. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. He's still not sure. If you have suggestions of what this genre of writing can be called, how do they contact us?
Through the website, or they can call KDVS right now and interrupt the reading.
That's 530-752-2777, or the website poetrytechnology.com. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Evan White. Evan, before you start, do you want some Indian music in the background for this performance?
I'll leave it up to you. It doesn't matter to me. You can decide.
Or
I'll take it if you'll pronounce the name of track 3.
Track 3, I think we've already heard.
Be that as it may, the name is impressive.
It is. It's Hamsa Dawi Tabla Duet, of course. This next track is Yaman Kalyan. Tell me if you find this distracting.
No, it sounds fine.
All right.
All righty. This is a story called The Plumber's Wife. My roommate Fiona and I found the photo of the little Asian boy in the drawer of an old wooden desk she bought on eBay. After wiping the dust off his picture, we decided to start telling people he was our son. He looks like a Ling, I said the moment I saw him. Fiona, still looking at the photo, took a moment longer. Like a Ling Ling, she said. He so does, I said, appreciating her idea and wishing I'd been the one to think of it. This here is our son, Ling Ling, I said from then on to guests who asked why his picture was in a frame that read, All Because Two People Fell in Love. Maybe we'd call the cable company and open the door to a grown man, shocked to find his childhood face framed and displayed in the home of complete strangers claiming to be his parents. This isn't you, I'd say, panicking. This is our son. He's gone now. The only thing we knew for sure about the boy in the photo, with his little pudding bowl haircut, white button-up shirt, and wide, curious eyes, was that he wasn't afraid of having his picture taken. After a while, we realized that people were surprised to learn we had no idea who he actually was. And when we explained that the little Chinese boy was our son, the child of a pair of white people, people's reactions varied. But Ling is a girl's name, someone said. When I repeated the comment to another friend, they said, But it's Ling Ling, as though in China, the combination of two feminine names produces a masculine result. To keep guests from thinking we were the type of people who only displayed the photos of strangers, Fiona added a small picture of her grandmother to the top of the entertainment center. One evening, a few weeks later, my friend Julia pointed to the photo of Fiona's grandmother and said, Found another one, huh? Who is the ugly old Asian woman? Fiona stopped knitting. That, she said, is my grandmother. Oh, Fiona, stop, Julia said. That's mean. Fiona was holding the knitting needles vertically, like steak knives, one in each hand. She is my grandmother, Fiona said, not some Asian. She's too ugly to be your grandmother, Julia said, attempting a compliment. Seriously, where did you find her picture? Did you buy another desk? Listen here, Fiona said, clenching her jaws, her knuckles white on the knitting needles. She is my grandmother, and she's not Asian, she's Assyrian. But she looks so different, Julia said, still with a confident tone. Your grandmother didn't look like this when I met her. Fiona's grandmother had been diagnosed with cancer in her foot some years after the photo was taken. Since then, she'd been on chemotherapy. Yes, Fiona said, because she has hair in that photo. Unlike Ling Ling, I knew Julia's story. She was born in Humboldt County, in a small, sheltered town where she lived until moving away to go to college, where I met her. I'd gotten to know her inadvertently. She had adopted me as her friend and confidant, a mistake she couldn't be blamed for making, but rather for sustaining. Julia loathed city life and assumed the only thing found in settlements of over 400 people was sin, and if you look hard enough on weekends or any day after midnight, more sin. These were things city folk didn't even notice anymore, she said, like heavy lifting on Sundays, which bespoke of profound evil. It's not your fault, she said, acting as though she were 65 instead of 19. You've lived in cities for so long, you can't be blamed for being a sinner. I said there was great truth to this, and when I fell into my inevitable life of crime, I hoped the judicial system would take the same approach when I was arraigned. Very little was untouched by her moral scrutiny. Tattoos, for instance, were the devil's way of marking you as his. Smoking was his way of acclimating you to the fires of hell. Piercings were how he decorated innocence with trophies of mutilation. And, above all, dyeing your hair was the surest possible sign one soul was destined to become Satan's concubine. In her eyes, if someone did any of these things, they were lost. If they hadn't, it was because they hadn't been presented with the opportunity yet. And, when the time came, they would fall into sin the same way everyone who lives somewhere with more than one liquor store did. I have morals, she said. I'm my own person because of it, too. I know who I am, and I am not threatened by people who hold that against me, she said. Who holds that against you? Everyone does, she'd say dismissively. People hate it when you're sure of yourself. Oprah says you teach people how to treat you, and I've taught people to respect me. I wonder if there's a way to teach others to subordinate themselves to me, I said, so that they'll do my bidding. That's what I'd like. The night Julia insisted that Fiona was tripping balls about her grandmother not being an Asian woman, we had been discussing body piercings. Moreover, Fiona and I had been listening, with surprise, to Julia renounce her, quote, overly opinionated initial stance. Life's not black and white, I've learned, she'd said. It's just shades of gray. Her time away from home, several months at that point, had opened her eyes to the rainbow of the world. The conversation turned then from piercings to the other popular thing people do to themselves with needles. And from jokes about heroin, we arrived at tattoos. It was then that she lifted her short dress up to her shoulders to reveal lacy underwear and the pair of sparrow tattoos. The birds were stylized like sports logos and looked the way a Nike brand bird food might. They were on either side of her waist at such angles that each was on a beeline path to her crotch. "What do you think?" she asked proudly, like she was showing us something she'd acquired through a miracle of chance. Fiona and I were silent. "I'm getting a cherry blossom tattooed up my side, too," she said, turning slightly with her dress still up, indicating a patch of skin from her waist to just below her shoulder. As I usually do when someone reveals to me a plan I think is terrible, I substitute an opinion with a question. "How much does that cost?" I asked. She said it would be about $500. God, why not buy drugs instead, I thought. Provided she wouldn't get addicted, once the use ran its course, she could move on without the lingering imprint of an enduring mistake. Just use clean needles. The least you can be is responsible. For quite a while before that, I'd been noting all of the things I'd seen Julia do or say to me. I enjoyed repeating to others her opinions on things like R-rated movies and Abercrombie ads, both of which were lures into acts of violence and sex, respectively. These gave way, after a few months, to different observations. Her refusal to use profanities was replaced by regular F-bombs. Bare skin became ink skin, and even her hesitancy to attend parties fell by the wayside. One afternoon, after the incident with Fiona's grandmother, Julia told me that she'd gone to a frat party over the weekend, where, she'd said in a hushed voice, she'd lost her virginity. Before continuing, she made me swear I'd never repeat the story. "You have my word," I said. She'd been drinking, she said, and she didn't even know the guy. They went back to his room, and when they finished, she'd slept with his roommate who'd come in just after. When the roommate kicked her out of the room, she retreated into the living room, still crowded with people, broken-spirited and disheartened. It was on the sofa that she met the third guy, who consoled her and who she followed to his room once she stopped crying. "What could I do? I don't regret it," she said, with one hand around a cup of coffee and the other on the table. She paused, looking at the lines on her palm. The tired girl across from me, wearing a hoodie and sweatpants, her blonde hair dyed auburn. "I just wish I'd made different choices." It was not long after her experience at the frat party that she told me she was in the happiest relationship of her life. Her name is Cheyenne, and she's in an open relationship with her boyfriend, Paul. I asked if her parents knew, and in response she told me about her latest ménage à trois with Paul and Cheyenne. "And my parents know," she said, "but they think it's all for attention. I'm just a really sexual person, you know? It just feels good to be wanted by so many people. It feels validating." "The real shame," she continued, "was that the camera wasn't recording." I was silent, as the devil so often is. "I guess Cheyenne didn't hit record," she said. "I was cuffed to the bedpost, so I couldn't check it, you know?" "I hate it when that happens," I said, and we both laughed. I met her online when she told me how she met Cheyenne. I responded as though it was an unremarkable detail I would never think of again. "What website was it?" Several weeks later, even her revulsion for cigarettes fell by the wayside. "If I wanted yellow teeth, I'd drink pee," she said, way back at the beginning, her round, glowing face still fresh and new, still a foreigner in the city. She stuck by her word for a while and smoked cigars at first, which were somehow classier than I'd have expected. This lasted until she finished the first box and realized a case of cigarettes cost half as much. She made a show of pulling a pink carton out of her purse and excusing herself, obviously. "Do you mind if I smoke? I've got a throbbing headache, and I haven't been able to smoke in for over an hour. Virginia Slims are the only things that works," she'd say dramatically, emphasizing the words in a way suggesting every conceivable option had been explored and found unsatisfactory. "I've been losing weight, too," she'd said, turning to look at me, smoke falling out of her mouth and floating up in front of her face. "Evan, you ought to try them." At the end of the year, Julia renounced her bisexuality for a heavyset plumber from a nearby city. Before I saw him, I wondered if he knew about her endeavors. Then I met him. a barrel of a man, he must have felt lucky to find a woman half his size, let alone a woman at all. And from that, I assume, grew his love for her, real, true, and genuine. It seemed he was the man she hardly deserved, but who, nevertheless, would never leave her and never let her down. A better lover, whatever the logistics, than she'd ever had, because he was someone with whom love actually applied. I kept up with her life for a while, but there came to be less and less to our friendship, meaning, of course, that she normalized and my interest waned. She and the plumber grew happier and happier with one another, settling into life together and into the assumption that they had found in one another the best the world had to offer. From what little I heard, he knew nothing of her exploits, though both of them enjoyed smoking. They moved in together after a short while, bought a pair of boa constrictors and a kitten, and decided that, unless the snakes escaped, they and their cat could be happy for a long time. The few times I saw them together, I found myself feeling something for Julia I'd not encountered before. It would be inaccurate to say it was nothing but happiness, but then I'd hardly had cause to feel happy for her before. Her happiness would, in my mind, and probably in her life, always be tainted, even if only slightly, by what had come before, as it does with all of us. She would finish her degree at a major university. In so doing, she would make more of herself than many people who make similar choices. But I still wondered if the Julia she had become ever thought about the one she'd been before. I see Julia out on their driveway in 10 years, seeing her husband off for the day. He gets into a white utility truck with the plumbing logo on the passenger door. He's successful. He owns his own business. In one arm, she holds their child, a person too young to understand what lies ahead or what came before, someone who does not yet know what it means to change or that beginning as one and ending as another, whatever the path, can carry a person into the future long after they've forgotten the past. Julia's husband waves to her before he backs out of their driveway and heads down the street and away. She goes inside and sets the baby in his crib. She'll sit then in a rocking chair beside the window and look out through her reflection, a blank face framed in a window pane, and ask herself again and again what I never did, what no one ever did. What happened to you?
That was Evan White reading to us a nonfiction narrative on KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. We'll be right back.